But we're speeding on a wee bit from that, and actually just a couple of housekeeping moments to actually start off with. First of all, there is a register that's going round. Hands up if you've got the register, if it's with you somewhere. Excellent. Make sure that passes round and everybody actually does sign into the register. Secondly, I'm not sure whether the institution has decided to actually create a sauna for our lecture environment. I have actually opened up some of the windows there. If anybody wants to open up any other windows at the back, please feel free to do so. I'll keep the door open. Otherwise, I think we might sort of asphyxiate ourselves, which would not be a good start for your first lecture. And I haven't lost a student yet over the years. Don't intend to lose now. So I just wanted to clarify that. So let's move on to the crux of what I want to share with you today and actually talk about and spend a few issues relating to. And that's this thing which some of you might have heard of, some of you might have come to it completely new. Some might say, what is this strange thing called news and newsreels? And why is the symbol of the cockerel there, why was it so iconographic in the 20th century, the early part of the 20th century, for a period of about 40 years? And also, as we go through this lecture, I'm going to actually point out the differences between newsreels and their approach to actually news, hard news, soft news, and so on, and the documentarians and their views and aims and objectives. Now, one of the most important developments of the 20th century was probably that of leisure time, increased leisure time. People having more things to do, more time to do them in. And there's a substantial growth of recreation and leisure, which led to obviously a whole range of other areas within that. As society became transformed by the growth of urban centres, cities, technology and so on, and greater industrialisation, certainly the media was struggling to keep up. For around about 100 years, print had been the dominant form, certainly in the 19th century, and for the majority of the 20th century. But there were new media kids that were coming on the block, one of which was radio, of course, and we'll talk about that with reference to the BBC in subsequent weeks. But the other area was obviously the notion of the moving image. This strange flickering thing that started quite literally at the start of the 20th century and opened up through Nickelodeons, through to various other elements, which actually provided recordings of events almost as they were happening in many ways. Certainly one of the most successful activities of the 20th century, which was cheap and relatively inexpensive to partake in for all of the population, was going to the cinema. By the end of the First World War, it was estimated that certainly the population of Britain all went to the cinema at least once a week. So you'd have a weekly trip to the cinema. It was a cheap night out, but the quality of the experience tended to vary. It also moved to the notion of obviously half the population and so on. And most early cinema was actually little more than a glorified parish hall, a bit like this room in Village Hall perhaps. Films were also shown to the troops in France, partly to increase morale, partly to actually open up propaganda elements. They were silent movies because sound doesn't begin to enter the picture until 1930. But it's still a way of actually addressing key areas relating to images that people are being shown. Again, that notion of a picture being worth a thousand words. Well, likewise, you've got a whole range of other areas. And there are a number of companies who begin to start developing a link within this, some of which you may well recall or may be acknowledging in terms of their presence today on platforms like Netflix, Amazon Prime and various other areas, or movie structures. Certainly the latter two, Paramount and Universal, have had various degrees of success across the decades. In terms of how newsreels were being put together, most of the makers tended to view them initially as illustrated newspapers. It's one of the reasons why the terminology for people working in cinema, working in newsreels, were things like editors, directors, reporters, and so on. So that kind of common terminology was maintained. I mentioned about the use for propaganda, something which is really a fascinating insight in terms of how news can be misused, misinformation can be developed. Certainly the Ministry of Information, which was originally noted as the Ministry of Propaganda, which was a big push for what some might say was early public relations, was very much at the end of the First World War a key element that was being developed and worked through. And the Ministry of Information in Britain had both a news division and it had a cinema division. The purpose of that was to ensure that the ministry would harness the cinema for propaganda, and it would also draw heavily on war reporters. There would be a range of productions which could include full-length silent documentaries, such as a series on battles. Again, you can look at these things online and so on, which showed major engagements in the First World War, such as the Battle of the Somme, Ardennes, and so on. Now, clearly, those were often tidied up for public consumption, and there weren't any of the shocking images that we would later see in the 1960s emerging out of Vietnam, for instance. But the fact of the matter was they were being used to transmit information and to work through key elements of a particularly significant part in British history 100 years ago, when this very ground was being used to test First World War tanks. In addition to that, newsreels would carry anti-German cartoons. They'd have films which would promote war savings. There would be lots of ways in which ordinary people could help boost the economy. So we have this notion of newsreels primarily being introduced as a way of propaganda to kind of fill in the bits between the entertainment. So you might well go and see sort of one aspect of the cinema movie that you want to go and see, perhaps a comedy, Keystone Cops, Charlie Chaplin, and so on, and then you sort of follow through with respect to the newsreels. So I talked about the five major newsreel promoters there: Gaumont, Movietone, Pathé, Paramount and Universal. Let's look at the kind of figures that work through from this basis. And let's jump ahead to 1930, which is particularly significant because that's when sound begins to emerge as a key element. Yes, pictures that actually talk as well as actually flicker on the screen from that point of view. In addition to sound, of course, you had the whole notion of cinematic constructions that we become more and more aware of. Use of music, use of the right kind of music, use of montage, use of ways in which images are put together to structure something, to give a message out. It's no coincidence whatsoever that the Soviet Union, America, Britain, most countries were aware of the power of the image and how things were being developed. Primarily because we're looking at the numbers of people that were going to the cinema. By 1939, in Britain, there were 5,000 cinemas. Some of those cinemas could seat up to 4,000 people, so substantially bigger than what you'd actually get with your average multiplex. 4,000 people, one screening. Around 20 million tickets were being sold each week, and the price was pretty much that of a pint of beer. So to go to the cinema, sixpence, go and see a movie, and the rest of the information that would be there. And just as today, I mean, I suppose the similar area is that you go, you see the trailers, you see the adverts, etc. You'd usually have a B feature, your second sort of string movie, you'd have a main feature, you'd have a series of trailers, you'd have the news as well. Again, a pre-television age. And that's critical in terms of understanding why newsreels kind of have evolved into maybe emerging in shows like The One Show and so on. Survey in Liverpool in 1937 found that 40% of Liverpudlians went to the cinema once a week, and around 25% actually went twice a week. In York, a survey found that half the population went to the cinema each week, which equated to around about 45,000 people. In other words, cinema as a result was very much big business. It was a way in which large numbers of people were going there and, as well as being entertained, were looking at it as a news service. There were a range of things such as Saturday morning matinees. There were a variety of other elements that were coming in with that. And a typical programme would normally last between 2.5 and 3 hours. You'd have a range of other elements that would come through. This billboard, obviously, at the end of the Second World War, very much encompasses the range of things that were there. It was also a fairly cheap way of keeping up to date with events without necessarily having to buy newspapers, although obviously they were still being sold and so on. Some of the early newspaper barons also bought into companies like Pathé and Gaumont, so again they were owning, or cross-media ownership was taking place. Those five companies that we mentioned, Gaumont British, Movietone, Pathé, Paramount, Universal, they pretty much produce around about 520 newsreels each year. So pretty much about 10 a week or thereabouts. So a lot of stuff being produced, but also a lot of stuff being built in for repetition and repeat viewing and so on and so forth. And there are approximately 2 million feet of those newsreels that actually exist in British archives, thanks to places like Mace, actually, partly the media archive for central England, but also the joy of digitisation. Because prior to newsreels being digitised, a lot of film was literally just exploding because of the nitrate that it was actually originally made from. It didn't have that longevity. It was kind of, you know, obviously after 30, 40 years, etc., things would decompose. So again, we do have a bit of a golden age to be able to see the sort of images that were actually there and still work through them. So was it all worthwhile? Big question to always ask yourself. Why? Why are these things taking place? Well, in addition to obviously providing communication, these could be seen as very much partial historical documents, clearly from a particular perspective, clearly from a particular point of view. They told us in many ways what the public were thinking about events or what the public would want to think about events. This particular call sheet from 1962 being an example of the kind of things that were coming through. Obviously, it's on the 24th of December, it's a Christmas Eve package, so you've got a range of things there that are focusing on festive activities and so on. But just as if you're involved with LSJ News or various other things, you're picking out key stories, what you're going to lead with. Personally, I think it's always essential that we have a baby chimp in there and ideally some automation in a restaurant because they're fantastic. You can't go wrong with a baby chimp, and I apologise for not having one to launch this first lecture, but I'll work on it. By 1939, as I mentioned, half of the population was attending the cinema and they were using that cinema as a news source. Okay? So they're seeing that cinema as a way in which they would be being informed about current events, whether that happened to be the Second World War or whether it happened to be various other events in the country and so on, or sporting events, cup finals, royal events, all the kind of lines from that point of view. Which half of the population, though, were pretty much going to the cinema? Well, actually, it was mostly in the north. In fact, there were the highest proportion of cinemas in the industrial north. And so as a result of that, you could say that a lot of cinema programming, and Hollywood actually coined the term Dream Factory as being a way of actually leading to people's aspirations, providing a form of escapism, providing an opportunity to actually look at a whole range of things. And lower income groups would probably go most often as opposed to the upper income groups, who possibly might be going to the theatre as opposed to the cinema in terms of their own particular area of expertise and work. So what did the average man then, or woman, actually want to see and hear? Well, newsreels pretty much served a perfect example of what sort of things you wish to actually follow through in terms of general material. But they were very conscious of not offending anybody. They didn't want to risk offence or to cause any problems with respect to that. And this policy of not offending anybody really impacts in terms of what we actually see. We look in seminars at some examples, and if you have a chance, look on Blackboard at the Pathé News site, look at some of the examples of things that are actually there, and you'll basically say it's really difficult, unless you take a very, very narrow view from the 21st century perspective of some of the commentary with respect to gender issues and so on, it's very difficult to actually find any of the newsreel material which was going to cause offence or be objectionable to. Even the propaganda, to a certain extent, which has a rationale. Obviously, you don't necessarily want to say that the British are hopeless and the Germans are wonderful, etc. You've got to take a different line on that. In general, newsreels tended to re-emphasise what were perceived as aspects of the British character. And what we see when you actually see newsreels in action is a range of things which, as with all classic media work, will provide a construction of an image, a construction of the kind of image that wants to be put out as the sort of thing you want to project. In other words, it's a reconstruction of that thing which is always quite nebulous and difficult to get hold of, a construction of reality. Now, Britain in the mid-1920s and 30s, even though clearly times had moved on, we were no longer at the height of empire, we were literally at a time where the empire as such was about to begin to deconstruct and decompose and so on, and independence was being sought by a number of countries, but Britain was still assumed to be a nation which was strong but fair. It had a secure commonwealth, and the class system, upper, middle, lower, was viewed very much as a natural and good system to work through. And any other viewpoints to that was simply not included. It could be said that when you listen to newsreels today, and again, we'll do this as an exercise in seminars, they do sound patronising. They often sound ill-informed. The kind of register in which the narrators speak is very much received pronunciation. Clipped, upper-class English, frightfully important to ensure that you actually have a particular line. You very, very rarely get any accents in newsreels unless they're Scottish or possibly Welsh. Any regional accent, no. And again, this is something which echoes with respect to what many people would say would be the hidden censorship that emerges in places from the BBC and their talks department. However, for all of the criticisms you can make against newsreels, there are certain newsreel elements, such as those which covered the Second World War, which undoubtedly had selling power and pulled in an audience. Newsreel coverage of the bombing of Coventry being a perfect example, and clearly the Blitz and so on. And there were a range of chains of specialist news theatres that actually began to develop to talk about this whole image of the newsreel and how it developed and so on. There was concern being expressed that actually this was doing something strange to human beings. All of these flickering images coming at you, as opposed to actually having the time to reflect on one static image on newspaper, to actually read it at your own leisure and so on. Bit like people having an obsession with, are you on your screen too much today? Is that a reason you can't sleep at night? Etc, etc, etc. There are a range of things that work through in terms of how you connect from that and what we actually see happening. So those kind of articles are being produced and so on. But at the same time, there is a sense of what's needed is some way to deconstruct that news, to actually point out and to actually have gatherings of people who gather in specialist news halls, news hotels, etc., to actually discuss what it was they were seeing and maybe watch it more than once. It's a standard way in which you'd actually decode most things these days. You'd watch it three times. First time, let it wash over you. Second time, begin to make one or two notes. Third time, begin to appreciate how things are going and what's being said. Again, in terms of the way that newsreels were developing, they were undoubtedly popular. But the managers of cinemas themselves, they were quite clear. They wanted entertainment. They didn't want to upset any patrons because obviously repeat business was fairly critical. If you want to go and see The Wizard of Oz 1 week, followed by Gone with the Wind, followed by, fine, great, it's part of that experience. So you don't want to suddenly have a jarring experience of a harsh situation somewhere in the world or somewhere in Britain about poor conditions and so on, which is going to take you out of that comfort zone. And it's a tension that we see emerging certainly in terms of why documentarians often took a particularly opposing view to newsreels, which they saw as trivial, which they saw as superficial, which they actually saw as being not necessarily doing the best they could for the citizenry and so on. And one of the reasons we get to that stage is editors then become a self-censoring group of people. Now, inevitably, you could say, yeah, but they had a captive audience. The population would go to the cinema to be entertained, to work through that process. But at the same time, there was still a collaboration in which, rather than risk the wrath of the government or any censorship, there would be discussion about what sensitive subjects should be handled and how, if they should be covered at all, they would be addressed. Like, for instance, the abdication in 1936 of King Edward. There was a lot of notion of what was the average taste being debated by newsreel editors. that anything with politics or indeed the monarchy was treated very carefully. It was definitely a case of respect. I mentioned Edward VIII when he abdicated in 1936. The decision that was made by the newsreel producers simply don't mention it at all. It's not happening. In a sense, it's interesting that it was made public, obviously, via radio initially. Other areas, such as the hunger marches in Jarrow, the sort of social movements that were taking place, again, were seen very much as being not necessarily the sort of thing which was traditionally British. And it all boils down to the fear factor. Fear of the introduction of censorship, fear of offending an audience, all leading to newsreels very much producing material which is uncontroversial. There weren't any views, there wasn't a particularly editorial stance. What you simply had was a statement of fact. Who actually won the FA Cup final? Who won Wimbledon? How did they actually go about it? And a very upbeat note. Again, throughout the Second World War, fine, because of the propaganda issues, because this was very much seen as hitting the right note and being appropriate for the time and very much in the national interest. All newsreel companies would carry extensive film libraries. And that film would then be cut and pasted. You'd have a series of stock shots. You'd have a lot of standard things which would be used, which would be replicated. Because the technology hadn't reached the stage where we have our citizen journalist mobile phone. You can click on that and get an image of all sorts of things working through that. You have a fairly bulky camera. You have lots of other things there. You pretty much have a news crew of between 3, 5, 7, or 8 individuals who have to go out and gather the stories. So it's not necessarily easy to just turn up on a slot. And there are lots of cases of where, as we'll see with the documentarians, certain images had to be faked, had to be constructed, had to be developed within the studio, as opposed to actually working through that. So, as we see newsreels developing into very much a genre, very much a brand, very much something which actually is connected with news, but probably coming from the perspective of what would be seen as soft news. And so we come to documentarians. And there is an image of what many people would regard, in terms of British documentary makers at least, as the founding father of the documentary film movement. A person who very much was keen to develop his own particular aspect of celebrating the ordinary, seeing how news would actually develop and work through that, but also digging underneath the surface, not simply taking the status quo and so on. The title Documentary Film Movement actually refers to a group of filmmakers who primarily did most of their key work from the 1920s to the 1950s. So you're pretty much looking at the central years and era of the 20th century. Although it is fair to say that their legacy, just as I said, the legacy of newsreels possibly is in things like The One Show and Soft News and other sort of aspects. The legacy of documentarians is that everybody from David Attenborough, right the way through to Louis Theroux, right the way through to a range of reality TV programs, probably at some level owes a lot of their particular work to what these guys were actually doing and how they were developing it, etc. The first feature film documentary, what was that? Again, it emerged in the early 1920s, arguably 1922, 23, etc. It was produced by Robert Flaherty, an American, and it was the first time that a feature-length film, lasting around about an hour and a half or so, had been produced about a real live subject. It was all about Eskimo life in the northern reaches of Canada. And that suddenly opened up a whole new range of possibilities. Because prior to that, feature-length movies were primarily fictional, even D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, although arguably carrying with it all sorts of racist overtones, etc., was ultimately a fictional reconstruction. The first movie that was actually developed by the Méliès brothers was based on Jules Verne's Rocket to the Moon back in 1902. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea had also been done as a silent picture in 1916. but a lot of fantasy elements, a lot of comedy, a lot of range of things that work through there. This was the first time that somebody had explicitly, as opposed to producing something which was based on a true story, this was a true story. A quote from the maker himself, and he's actually there, about there, as a young sort of Robert Flaherty. "Even in my youth," he says, "I was always exploring new country. My father was a mining engineer, and in manner of speaking, we were a nomad family. We moved from one gold mining camp to another in various parts of Canada. I was then about 12 years of age. I learnt to track and hunt rabbits from the Indians, and I had an Indian dog team and toboggan. It was frontier country where the Indians were much more primitive than they are now." Robert Flaherty was very much an idealist. He had this image, partly because of his experiences of a youth, of the noble savage, the nobility of nature. The fact that as America was expanding, as it was taking over the Gold Coast, California, Alaska, and other sort of areas, somehow something was being lost. And one of the things that he wanted to actually do was to actually develop a record and produce a record of a way of life. But again, there are certain constraints, one of which is financial. Flaherty is mostly a middle-class oriented soul. He's not got a sustainable income as such. So actually, Nanook of the North was paid for primarily by a French company that actually dealt in fur trapping. They are actually supporting the actual company itself from that point of view. There are other areas where you see it that shots that were there physically could not have been made by the technology that were there and were set in a studio. So that notion of it's real opens up a whole question of, yeah, how real, who's real, what's the perception, and so on. Nevertheless, Flaherty's work, huge influence on John Grierson. He's on the right-hand side there, as you can see. This is taken in the early 1930s. Grierson was somebody who was very much committed to using the technology to report hard news, to develop that. As I've already mentioned, he was pivotal in documentary development within Britain and arguably beyond. Let's find out a little bit more about his background, who he is, who he was, how he developed, and so on and so forth. Well, he was born in 1898, and he was born in Scotland. He went to university, common ground there. So he was educated. He fought in the First World War as a minesweeper, and he went to the United States to study the new exciting social sciences. Not the natural sciences of physics, chemistry, biology, etc., but the new science of psychology. The psychology of public opinion. The psychology of public opinion. That, in many ways, could be seen as another word for propaganda. How do you manipulate people's views? How do you manipulate people's thoughts? Why is it that things like sociology and psychology and economics suddenly start emerging as academic subjects that can really be developed in their own right and are subsequently followed down the line by things like communications, journalism, public relations, and so on? Why is it actually deemed to be useful? Well, partly it's because the Industrial Revolution had proven that the application of science could lead to a lot of progress. So why not applying similar things to the social sciences to maybe structure a system which would work? Now, the 20th century probably had two massive extremes of this. You have communism in the Soviet Union, China, and so on, and you have capitalism in the United States and countries, various shades of those two themes accordingly. But Grierson was very much driven by idealism. And the idealism that Grierson was driven by was similar to the sort of things that Charles Dickens and other writers in the 19th century had actually had when they wanted to actually use journalism as a force for change and use the technology that was actually in that to actually develop their own system. Now, Grierson was operating against a background, certainly in Scotland, of severe social crisis. There was a lot of poverty in the aftermath of the Great War, as it was seen. There was a lot of recession material coming through there. There was a huge migration of the Highlanders of the Scottish lands and the Irish to the Scottish cities. Urban slums are being developed and sadly are forming as a result of this. And in the period between 1870 and 1930, Scotland pretty much had the worst housing conditions in Europe. There was disease, there was alcoholism, there was illegitimacy, the expectation of life was very low, and the expenditure that the government would actually give to the poor was the lowest they could manage in any way, shape or form. These are conditions which in the Soviet Union had led to a revolution. There was a lot of class conflict. This, as Grierson saw it, unbridled capitalism had a gross misuse of resources, and the difference between the rich and the poor was immense. Was this simply a case of people were happy to be exploited? Were they happy to be subject to this huge deprivation scenario? How were things developing? Well, there was a labour movement that was emerging, but the labour movement at the time was dominated primarily by what will be seen as respectable, moderately skilled workers opposed to radicalism. So that class system, which I spoke about with respect to the newsreels, was still very much in evidence. More than just a respect culture, a deference culture was very much in there. And the Scottish labour movement, certainly in the 1920s, was dominated primarily by a pro-capitalist liberal party. The unskilled Scottish workers, whether they were in the shipyards of Glasgow or Govan or Clyde, would often be seen as impoverished, disorganised and fragmented. So again, Grierson is looking at this from the ideological perspective of saying that everybody should be free to pursue individual happiness. Almost an American ideal, really. That actually you shouldn't just be restricted to a particular status in society because of your place of birth. You should have the opportunity to deal with a free market without state intervention. And this notion that people will get what they deserve and everything will find a natural level wasn't necessarily the best way to go. Between the Great War, or the First World War, and the Second World War, the documentary film movement, as a result, became associated with the political left. This was a case of where, if you were a happy middle-class family who kind of not worried about the poor in Nottingham or Scotland or various other bits, but you know, if you went to the cinema or if you chose or you saw a documentary, you would see quite categorically images of things that were part of life. It may well be a celebration of life, but in the same way as we look at reality television today, you get a construction of what's being seen. In other words, for the first time, Grierson and his associates are giving some kind of voice to the underrepresented working class. And that whole notion of representation, critical. What are the lead stories? What are the messages that are actually there? How do you actually develop that whole side of things? Between the seminar this morning and this lecture, I did two radio interviews focusing on the notion that finally it's discovered that actually there's no difference between men and women when it comes to their approaches to management. They're both equally successful or bad. It's like, whoa, startling, amazing. You know, people can actually go through the glass ceiling. Good grief. But, you know, that's still a current contemporary issue. So there's still lots of things that are developed within that whole field. Equally, it was also seen that the documentary movement was a kind of reaction to what was seen very much as a middle-class, fairly stuffy British film industry. It wasn't as dynamic, as sexy, as exciting as Hollywood. It wasn't producing, even though, obviously, in the case of Colin Clive and Frankenstein, you had a number of British directors working in Hollywood, you didn't have the range of dreams being developed on that side of things within Britain. And the documentary movement, as a result, established itself under two consecutive forms. There were two particular bodies which worked on to develop their own particular aspect to represent this. I mean, again, these are taken in the 1920s and 30s. You might initially think it has to be a lot earlier than that. It has to be the 1840s, 1850s. You still hadn't had any change or any development in terms of what people were seeing, where they were developed, etc. And there was a need to drive information and ensure that health messages were developed and put together. The Empire Marketing Board, which existed, as you can see there, between 1927 and 1933, was specifically set up to ensure that messages relating to nutrition, messages relating to appropriate ways forward, and health issues could be transmitted and developed within that. Likewise, the General Post Office, and finally, the Crown Film Unit. All of which, as you can see there with the strapline, "Eat more fish," put in the background, were ways of what would be a cheap, nutritious meal that people could actually consume if you were part of the working class. Well, fish and chips became a major part of that whole sort of sequence. And Grierson's also connected with this because, obviously, he needs to make a living. You can't just literally set up and say, I want to change the world from that point of view. So he's working within the system to actually develop that, and also working with government to kind of improve the overall lot. I mean, we still have it now with Public Health England. We have a whole range of other areas where there are campaigns that are being developed, which are percolated through that cross tunnel between journalism, public relations, and back again, and so on. This is the first example of what many people would actually say was Grierson's equivalent to Nanook of the North. It was one of a series of things that he actually did and worked through. There was a perception that was seen, it was probably a middle-class perception, that somehow documentary films were superior to films that were purely entertainment or merely entertainment because they took a specific authorial stance vis-a-vis Drifter. And Grierson's line very much was based on four particular elements. First of all, he believed that the state should intervene for the greater good. He believed that the state, that's government and so on, should prevent individuals threatening the community with selfish desires. He also believed in the goals of society, that actually there was such a thing as society, in which each individual should develop its full potential, or his or her full potential, and that there would be a unity based on the general good of all. So it's a kind of a utilitarian philosophy that he's arguing for. Now, it may well be that that was, and can be seen, as a little bit naive. It's not connecting with what we would regard as the real world, then or now. But maybe it was a mixture of those ideas which developed whilst at university, whilst studying the social sciences, whilst evolving to fit his own experience as a reality, that kind of we see these things being developed. And he also maintained that technology should be seen as a way of improving communication between the state and corporations to the people. There should be an aim very much which would be designed to advance social cohesion, and these aims should be both educational aims and social aims. A quote directly from Grierson himself: "I have no great interest in films as such. I look on cinema as a pulpit and use it as a propagandist." The films that he produced were certainly wide-ranging, Drifters being one of them. They were also collaborative. It wasn't a case of Grierson and his camera. There were a whole group of people actually working together with respect to this. They were quite technically innovative. We were using things such as fades, crossfades, various other elements within that, and there were a broad range of approaches that were taken. So you had a mixture of what we would refer to now as cinematic literary tropes that were being developed. Things like voiceovers with poetry, things like montages, things like surrealism. Elements would all actually come through to develop the sort of line that were there. And many of the sort of areas that were there were seen to demonstrate the public working for the common good and for the social good. Drifters was an original documentary that was designed to actually demonstrate the real Scottish fishing industry. But there are a couple of key aspects. It's presented as real. And indeed, shots that were actually shown, if you look at it, demonstrate us now the quay side. Oh, they're sailing off, etc., etc. Yes, they might well have been. But then the impression is given that the camera and us as the audience goes along with them. Actually, we don't, because all of the interiors of Drifters were shot on a studio set, just as when they were doing a mixture of the Royal Mail on a train service, they basically sort of were set indoors, and again, people wouldn't move the set and so on. So you have a clear range of things there. The fish, you think, whoa, fishing industry, look, real fish, etc., was actually shot at Plymouth Aquarium behind the glass. You can actually see, if you look again, you see the sort of a reflection in the glass, etc. But the question is, so what? Are they basically being deliberately manipulative? Well, yes, but do the ends justify the means? Okay, documentary about the British film industry, about the Scottish herring industry, and you've got a lot of fake constructed images there which are purporting to be true. Is that something which should have been declared and so on? Tell that to Mr. Attenborough when he actually sort of shot footage of a polar bear actually in a zoo as opposed to going up to the Arctic. It happens. Again, ethical issues need to be talked about and discussed from that point of view. Again, one of Grierson's associates, Alberto Cavalcanti, also committed to this. Now, Cavalcanti actually studied architecture in France, and he was very much a believer in avant-garde filmmaking. Again, opening things through. Film as a generic form has got so many sort of areas and approaches that it can actually take. Whatever aspect you're looking for, it opens up a whole range of things within this. And together with Grierson, Cavalcanti very much focused on how these films were being developed, because he had an understanding of film techniques, with even introducing early special effects and so on. There's Cavalcanti. And there is a real person, a coal miner, or not, an actor. Again, whole range of things there. Humphrey Jennings is a gentleman who very much comes to the fore, again, as a colleague of both Grierson and Cavalcanti, working in Britain, and he produced this thing, Listen to Britain, quite clearly aimed at the United States of America, quite clearly aimed to ensure that American people attending the cinema, seeing how plucky Britain was actually doing in battling the Blitz and continuing to work through that process, needed support from that point of view. The very name, Listen to Britain, it's pure propaganda designed to encourage a commitment of America to enter the Second World War, which clearly obviously was helped by the attack on Pearl Harbor, but that's a different line. But Jennings actually, because again, challenges with respect to the notions of getting equipment to places at a particular time, actually would set warehouses alight, film them, and claim that they'd been bombed by German bombers. Again, ends, means, etc., etc. Basil Wright actually produced a movie called a documentary called Song of Ceylon, C-E-Y-L-O-N, in which he talked about the effect of modernity and industry on traditional ways of life. Again, at a time where India is seeking independence, you're working through that process. You've also got echoes here of Robert Flaherty, 20 or 30 years later, actually looking at the same sort of thing, the notion of the noble savage and other areas as well. And of course, getting back to Britain, we have the classic notion of social deprivation and problems from there. Now, this reason was still in this particular area quite significant, because a traditional form of the way the media works is it's very rare that you get, unless they're newsreaders or politicians, people looking directly at you from the screen. But this sense that, again, that celebration of the ordinary working person in a programme or a shot which is aimed and constructed to ensure that working class people can contribute directly to the camera about their problems kind of carries with it that notion of this is not an actor, this is a real person. And indeed, in many cases, they actually were living in the sort of environment and working through that process. Again, early examples of Big Brother, possibly The Circle, without the sort of likes and so on, but again, issues with respect to that. And of course, I mentioned Nightmail, which in many ways was actually used as a way of filling in programmes for the first 20 or so years of television, when the BBC would actually use interludes and various other things. And it's well worth seeing online and actually looking at that, because it's a very well-made film that's been put together. But that is a stage set. That is not, spoiler alert, etc., the actual line that's there. And what we actually have here is images of that put together with the classic W.H. Auden poem, which goes, "This is the nightmail crossing the border, bringing the check and the postal order. Letters for the rich, letters for the poor, the shop on the corner, and the girl next door." Again, it all works. It's all part of that construction. But if you're being, some might say, absolutely over, you should say, but you can't, I mean, you can't possibly sort of fake it. It's fake, isn't it? Or is it? As we said, fires were started, a whole range of sort of issues, just to get the story together. Now, again, the argument that goes along with that is, well, isn't that partly at the heart of public service broadcasting? Isn't that sort of part and parcel of what also, in the still image, really impacts what we see in the 20th century? Capturing reality. This was a phenomenally popular publication which lasted for about 20 years, set up by a Jewish-German emigre in Britain. Worked extremely well. It provided those snapshots of reality and folk effectively doing ordinary things. You know, whether they're at the beach reading the notion of My Reply to Goebbels, the whole, or Blackpool from that sort of point of view, it's working through that process. In other words, it's providing elements of social realism. Not a monkey, but at least it's a panda bear, isn't it? You know, I mean, something like that. 1939, a few months after this, he might have been bombed. Never mind. So a whole range of sort of issues relating to this whole aspect of public service broadcasting, reality and images that we see there, including, as we actually would also see, representation of race, not just gender, race and other issues that are coming through there, and the migrant population and so on and so forth. But there's also that lead into the notion of public information films, lines like coughs and sneezes spread diseases, ways within that whole system, all of which are ways of getting messages across. Okay, picking out a couple of sort of final things there. Consider, for seminar discussion next week, the interrelationship between documentaries and newsreels. They both use images, they both use moving images. What are the things that you're actually seeing on that basis? How effective actually are they at getting their point across? And how do they also resonate in 2018 with some of the areas and the manipulative ways in which, again, similar sort of things, including yourselves, will be using and applying things to get messages across? This hopefully will be up as a podcast as well, certainly in the next few days, all being well. Make sure you've signed the register. Thank you for your time, and I'll see you all next week.